It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll look at why drug companies are making eye drops that are too big for our eyes and find out how the cost gets passed along to the patients who rely on them.
First, five staff members at the state's troubled youth prison were sent to the hospital over the weekend after two separate incidents of assaults by inmates. In recent weeks, there have been reports of other assaults, and last month, a group of inmates allegedly attempted to electrocute a guard.
The Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls have been under intense scrutiny in recent years with multiple lawsuits and an FBI investigation into the treatment of inmates there. But the safety of staff members now appears to be an increasingly important issue, especially after a federal judge ordered drastic changes earlier this year in how prisoners are managed.
Patrick Marley joins us now. He covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been following the events at Lincoln Hills. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Patrick, what do we know about the latest assaults on staff members at Lincoln Hills?
So we know that there was quite a bit of activity late on Sunday night. The inmates stay in cottages. There's a dozen of them scattered around the campus. And one inmate acted up and required several staff members to intervene. They took them to the wing of the institution where they have solitary confinement. After they had him in handcuffs and were trying to get him to a van, a scuffle developed, and a number of people were injured in that incident. I believe three were injured, and there was a woman who tore her meniscus. There was a knee to the abdomen of one worker. And after that inmate was taken to the secure area the higher security area of the prison, then a second inmate in the same cottage had acted up, and they got a report on that. When they came back, they found that a window had been broken out of the door to his cell, and that he had broken up a plastic chair and was throwing pieces of it out this window. He hit one worker in the face. They used their pepper spray, and then the worker who got hit in the face with a piece of the chair was injured, as was another worker. So there was a total of five staff who ended up going to the hospital. There was also some restlessness in other cottages where inmates were refusing to go into their rooms that has caused some concern for staff up there.
And so this just happened, you know, this Sunday, but this isn't an isolated incident. We know that there were other assaults that have taken place at the facility recently. What happened in those events?
Probably the one we know the most about happened earlier this month on October 11th. There was an inmate who was in the solitary confinement area of the prison and was in a classroom. So he was there with two other inmates in a small room where they're supposed to get their education. And he got riled up and punched a teacher in the face, gave her a black eye, knocked her out. She was sent to the hospital for a couple of days. She had to have a heart monitor installed for this. And then there's at least one other assault that resulted in someone going to the hospital this month that I'm aware of at that institution.
So, you know, what are staff members saying about the culture or the environment at Lincoln Hills right now?
You hear a lot of fear from staff right now. In conversations I've had with them, they say that they've always known working in a prison is an environment where you never quite know what's going to happen and you have to be very concerned about safety. But that particularly in recent months, they've gotten very worried about it, are concerned for their own safety, concerned for the safety of their peers. Recently, Senator Tom Tiffany, his district includes this prison, got communications from perhaps 10 staff raising concerns about specific incidents or just the general climate of the facility.
And, you know, Senator Tom Tiffany from Hazelhurst is not alone in, you know, taking up this as an issue. We know that Representative Mary Felskowski, a Republican from Irma, has also said that, you know, the changes that were called for by the federal judge, they need to be put back in place, that workers need to be able to, you know, get inmates back in line as it was. You know, how are they trying to work forward to, you know, either re-implement those policies or, you know, try to find another solution?
Right. So the recent activities that have sort of come into the limelight are incidents that have occurred since this judge put restrictions on how Lincoln Hills can operate this summer. He required the state to scale back its use of solitary confinement, its use of handcuffs, and its use of pepper spray. And a lot of staff there say that they feel like their hands are tied and that it's worsened the safety there. Senator Tiffany and Representative Felskowski fall in with that view as well. They wrote a judge, the judge who issued that injunction, a letter to lift his order, essentially. Today, in fact, the judge responded to them, said that he takes security of the facility as a priority, but he noted that when he gave general guidelines to what his specific order would be, he told the state and the attorneys who sued the state to negotiate on how that would work and to keep safety in mind, that the order that he put in place had taken into account those issues, and that since he's issued his injunction, the state, as a party to the case, has not asked the judge to lift that order or change that order in any way. They have not appealed the decision. The judge has asked, just today again, that they file a report by November 10th to give a sense of what the actual climate is, what's happening there, what the safety concerns may be.
We're talking to Patrick Marley right now. He covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about some recent incidents that happened at the Lincoln Hills School for Boys. And, you know, meanwhile, on the opposite front, Democratic Representative Chris Taylor has been circulating a bill that would require the prison actually be closed within 1 year. She's still looking for support on that bill. But, you know, given this makeup of the legislature as it is right now, would this actually go anywhere?
I think it's hard to see where that gaining a lot of traction at the moment. The Republicans control the legislature. They have largely been hands-off on issues at Lincoln Hills and leaving it to the Department of Corrections. They did give them some additional staff and resources that they were looking for in the state budget, but they really looked to the Department of Corrections to resolve this. If Taylor's bill were to be adopted and this facility were closed in a year, they would have to put these inmates somewhere, and you know, there's no guidance in that legislation as to where they would go. So the Department of Corrections would have to come up with a new plan very quickly for where to hold these 150 or so inmates.
So we've been talking about what lawmakers are saying about what's happening at Lincoln Hills. But, you know, just even within the last week, Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary John Litcher told reporters that it's safe for inmates there. You know, how, and for staff, obviously, you know, how is that comment sitting, especially given what we know now?
I can't tell you how many staff I've heard from since he made that comment who have complained bitterly about his sentiment that it's safe. They say it's not. They think that it's just not credible for him to make that claim. He stands by it. I mean, the department is very firm that they see this as a safe institution for both the inmates and the staff, and that things that have been happening there are overblown.
And insofar as you know, are there any other bits of legislation or initiatives that could make Lincoln Hills safer just in the interim?
There were some offers of budget amendments that would have provided more staffing for the facility. You know, they didn't go as far as the Democrats wanted. They did add some staff that Governor Walker had recommended. Today, Governor Walker said that the head of Lincoln Hills, the superintendent, recently stepped down to a lower position at the facility. So it's being run by the deputy superintendent. Today, the governor said that he wanted an interim superintendent hired while they look for someone to hold that position full time. I talked to some Democratic lawmakers today who said that's well and good, but that doesn't help address their staff shortage that they have up there, which they see as one of the big problems there, that it's pretty standard for them to be running with less than a full crew there. That's raising concerns about their ability to keep the place in shape.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be in touch again about having you back with us. Patrick Marley covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been covering the ongoing story at Lincoln Hills.
Coming up, we'll find out why eye drops are too big for human eyes and how that creates waste and higher costs. Stay with us here on Central Time. If you've ever put an eye drop in your eye, you know that it certainly feels like an imperfect process. Even when you get the drop square on target, there's often some overflow leading to excess medication dripping down your cheek. You might even think you missed or you're doing it wrong, but chances are you're doing it right and the cost of those drops is dripping away.
Our next guest says that many drug companies make the typical eye drop larger than the human eye can hold, and that really isn't an accident. He says these companies are aware that's happening and have done nothing to fix it. That's leading to wasted drugs and wasted money, and in some cases it does put patients at risk.
Marshall Allen joins us now. He's a reporter for ProPublica, where he covers patient safety and healthcare costs. His latest reporting has looked at the many ways healthcare dollars are being wasted in the United States. Marshall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me here.
Well, people might hear eye drops and think about that, you know, Visine or generic of that and think, oh, that's pretty cheap. We're not wasting that much money. But some of those prescription eye drops, and you also read about liquid cancer medications, it's really expensive stuff to be wasting.
Oh, it's incredibly expensive. You know, a cheap bottle of Visine, obviously that's almost something you feel like you could throw away without losing a lot of money. But a lot of these drugs can cost hundreds of dollars a bottle, especially for something like glaucoma medications and people who take medication for chronic dry eyes. And so if those drops are being made larger than they need to be, that's causing patients to run out of their bottles too soon and have to replace their bottles too soon. And in some cases, that's expensive. In other cases, you know, your insurance company might not let you get a replacement soon enough, and you could go days without your medication. And that's really dangerous for people with glaucoma who are using that eye drop to prevent blindness.
So talk about the difference between the size of the drop that gets dispensed out of those medical eyedroppers and what our eye can actually take in at once.
Well, so, you know, it's amazing how little this has been studied. I mean, the study that everyone cites goes all the way back to almost like 50 years ago. But they estimate that the eye can hold at most an additional 23 microliters of fluid. And the typical drop is anywhere from 20 microliters up to 70 microliters. So most drops contain more liquid than your eye can contain. And some of them are two or three times bigger than what your eye can contain. And so really it's the effect of like pouring water into a glass that's already full. It just overflows and there's no therapeutic effect.
Now, stepping away from the cost for a moment, in some cases, this can be maybe not dangerous, but it can create some side effects, burning eyes and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's another thing that's really interesting. I don't know if you or any of your listeners have ever had the sensation of tasting your eye drop.
Sure.
But your eye drops actually can get ingested. The excess eye medication can get ingested through the ducts of your eye into your sinuses and then into your body. And that can actually be dangerous for some of these really potent medications.
Do we have a sense of how much money is being literally dripped away one drop at a time?
So that's really hard to estimate. But, you know, the market for just glaucoma drugs and chronic dry eye drugs, those bring in for drug companies about $3.4 billion per year. So it's a huge market for eye drops. With cancer medication, that's the other thing I looked at with this story. Single-use cancer vials are estimated to waste about $1.8 billion in healthcare spending. And that's a study by Dr. Peter Bach at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital out here in New York.
And you talked to some patients who have this problem, who use the eye drops for things like glaucoma treatment. Can you talk about people like Gregory Matthews, who relies on those drops?
Yeah, so Gregory Matthews is a glaucoma patient, and you know there's a lot of people like him around the country, and he has to take drops every morning and every night to keep the eye pressure down in his eyes, and that actually protects him from blindness. Now, Gregory said no matter how hard he tries, every time he puts in his drops, you know, they're running down his face. And he didn't know, and I think most patients don't know, that the drug companies are actually selling you more medication than you can possibly use. And so he's had the problem of running out of his drugs. And, you know, when he runs out of his eye drops, you know, he blames himself. You know, he just thinks he did something wrong. But he's also panicked because he could become more blind, you know, if he doesn't take his drops every morning and every night. So when he realized that the drops are just frankly too big for his eyes it actually made him kind of angry. You know, he felt betrayed. It felt like his trust had been violated.
Talking to Marshall Allen from ProPublica. He's been reporting on wasted medical expenses. We're talking now about one of his most recent pieces, eye drops and some other liquid medications. They come in serving sizes, doses that are too big for us to absorb. And Marshall Gregory didn't know that these eye drops were being made too big. But you talked to people who'd worked for the drug industry who knew and have known it for a long time. And there's been research on fixing it to make more appropriate dispensing tools.
Yeah, so, you know, the research on this goes back for decades, and probably the most interesting case study that I highlighted was the drug company Alcon. Alcon is a big, giant drug company. It's now owned by Novartis, and they specialize in eye care. Back in the early 90s, they wanted to try and make eye drops less irritating, you know, less side effects, less itching and burning when you put them in. And so they created what they called a micro drop. So in their research and development department, you know, in the lab, they made this little drop that was about half the size of a regular drop. It was only 16 microliters, so there was no waste with that drop. It could completely be absorbed into the eye. And they found that it was just as effective. It was a glaucoma drug, so it was just as effective in reducing the pressure in the eye. It also didn't cause as many side effects, and all the patients preferred using it. But when it came to actually bringing it out on the market, they decided that it might have too many questions and might cause too many problems with their revenue and their profits, and so the company ended up killing the project.
Right, because if you're selling this to the board at a corporation, you're saying, hey, I've invented this thing that allows us to sell about half the amount of product that we usually sell. It's really going to make a financial difference.
Exactly, and that's kind of the thing. It raised so many questions about what they would do. You know, they also had to think through, well, are we going to now change all of our products to micro drops? Are we going to change the prices? Because if we don't change the price and keep the price the same, then our competitors are going to accuse us of charging more for our eye drops. You know, it's a real cutthroat industry, and they just had to think through all these variables, and in the end, they just decided not to risk it.
So the technology exists to cut this waste. Is any company actually using this in, say, eye drops?
There is no micro drop available right now in the United States. There are some different companies who are trying to do it, and there are some different countries in Europe that are doing it. So, you know, this is a wide open field, and we may see something like that in the future. There's other, you know, attempts to do things. Eye drops are not a good way to put medication in. I mean, you know, it's hard to administer them. Patients, especially elderly patients, have a hard time administering them. And so, you know, they're trying different technologies to improve it.
And you write, by analogy, imagine if you were taking a pill that's a medication. For every one pill you take, you throw away one or two more.
Well, that's what it's like, you know. And this is where I really, the point I'm trying to drive home with all these stories about wasted medical spending, this is our money, you know, this is our spending. So a lot of times you may have insurance, but you're paying for that insurance. There's out-of-pocket costs that are involved. That insurance is part of your overall compensation as an employee. And so if your employer could spend less on your insurance coverage, they might be able to pay more for your salary. These are our taxpayer dollars for Medicare plans, for Medicaid plans. This is our money collectively that's being wasted. And it's being wasted to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year when you add it all up.
So the companies don't want to take advantage of the technology that could fix this. Is there a federal regulatory agency like the Food and Drug Administration that could do something here?
Well, that's just it. There's not. I mean, you would think that the FDA would care about this, but the FDA's mission is to really look at the safety and the effectiveness of drugs. They're not looking at whether or not drugs could be delivered in a way that's less wasteful or less expensive.
How about something like, I'm brainstorming here, insurance companies or Medicare, people who are spending money on this, would they have leverage to push for this?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe, but I mean, you know, maybe Medicare would, because Medicare is big enough and they're national, you know, but insurance companies are very fragmented. It's really hard to say. I mean, but, you know, no one can really force a drug company to do something. A drug company would have to see the opportunity to, you know, offer some savings, and they're not really incentivized to do that. I mean, they're in the business of bringing in revenue and making profit for their investors, so it's just not something they're incentivized to do.
in this piece and others you're looking at, you know, a lot of people look at the cost of insurance and the cost of healthcare coverage. You're looking at the basic costs here. As you start to turn over stones and look at all these stories, are there a lot of opportunities like this to cut waste and save money?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been trying to look at just the black and white examples, like just waste is examples where we are blatantly just throwing things away that are still good or still useful. And I mean, I'm just one person. I'm identifying billions and billions of dollars being wasted every year if you look at just the stories that I've done. You know, you would hope that somebody might, and I've also tried to show solutions in each story I've done. So it doesn't have to be this way. And so my hope, I guess, is that as consumers feel more and more pressure from the rising healthcare costs, you know, we are really having more money taken from us every single year because of the rising healthcare costs that are eating up an even larger and larger portion of our economy every year. And at some point, consumers are going to say, we can't handle this anymore. And people are already saying that. So I do think that we're kind of reaching the breaking point, and maybe that then will spur some change.
Are you getting response as you publish these pieces from people in the public saying, yeah, what do we do to change this?
Yeah, you get huge response. You get huge response. But, you know, who really represents the patients and who speaks for the patients? That's just the hard part. You know, there are definitely some employer groups who push for change. So they have an opportunity, but you know, the rest of the healthcare industry, you know, they're the ones making the money. So they don't really want to push for the change.
Marshall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. And I just want to remind people, you can go to ProPublica.org and just look at the series Wasted Medicine, and you can see all the stories there.
That's Marshall Allen, reporter for ProPublica. His recent piece there is Drug Companies Make Eye Drops Too Big and You Pay for the Waste.
Coming up after the news, our next guest says that one of the best ways to help girls be more confident is to allow them to be funny. We'll learn more after the news. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
As more women enter fields previously dominated by men, there has been a lot of talk about the best ways to help girls feel more empowered and find their voices.
Our next guest says that helping girls find and cultivate their sense of humor can be a good first step in building that confidence.
Ellen McCarthy is with us now. She's a staff writer for the Washington Post Style section. She recently wrote about girls and humor. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So looking at this piece, this is just part of, the nuanced conversation about empowering girls. So why did you want to look at humor?
You know, my interest was sparked, in truth, after the election, when I noticed that some of the people who were coming out most powerfully in the resistance were women with backgrounds in comedy, meaning the Chelsea Handlers and Amy Schumers of the world. And it just sort of made me interested to think, you know, why is it that these women, you know, thinking of Samantha Bee even, are finding that they have a voice and a way to reach people that others weren't? And it sort of just sent me down a trail of sorts that made me really think about the ways that women and women's humor are treated and shaped in this world. And what I found was that there are some ways that women and girls are socialized out of using humor, and it's really subtle. Nobody ever says, oh, don't be a funny girl, or don't use your sense of humor, little girl. It's much more subtle than that. But even just getting the message, girls aren't funny, you know, that sort of thing seeps in. So these women who sort of bucked that and overcame it, it seems to me they got really used to using their voice. And so when there came a time when it was important to use their voice, it made sense to me that they were the ones who stepped up.
Now, and you spoke with a lot of women for this piece, and they ranged from ages, 13 to 37. For women who were already in the workforce, who are a little bit older, what were their experiences?
Yeah, so a lot of them sort of were able to think back and say, you know, gosh, I was a really funny little kid, But then I remember getting these messages, oh, sit still, be more quiet, tamp it down a little bit, hush, hush, or, you know, that's really not what ladies do, or, you know, act like a lady, meaning don't laugh so loudly, don't be so loud, don't be bawdy, don't be crass. Words that are often very, very gendered, right? When you think about even the words that are used to talk about women and humor, it's words like brass, you know, words that you don't hear applied to for men. So what these women often told me was that they were funny as little kids, but then something happened. You know, those subtle messages got through, and they often hid it into a private space with only their female friends, or hid it all together so that it was just sort of their internal monologue that became their sense of humor, and they didn't let it out into the world. And so for some of them, once they got through high school and sort of said, I don't care what anybody is telling me, I'm funny and I'm going to use it, they were able to reclaim that voice. But for others who I spoke to both for the piece and then who I received a lot of reactions after that, felt that it never really fully came back. And that, to me, is the really sad part, that if you're not using that sense of humor when you're in junior high and when you're in high school, then you're missing out on all of this time practicing, right? Because using humor is a skill like any other skill, and if that muscle doesn't get used, it really can weaken and wither, and then it becomes much harder to flex it once you get into the workplace. And what we found is that it's a huge asset to have in the workplace. There are studies that show that when somebody is perceived as being funny, they're also perceived as being more confident, more competent, and they're more likely to be elected into positions of leadership. And gosh, those are things we want for our girls.
Sure. I mean, and it is really interesting to hear that humor is not necessarily something that comes naturally to people. Even the funniest people have to get that reinforcement that they are funny, and then they have the confidence to move forward. And even finding humor in what might seem like banal situations, being able to make something funny takes, you know, a fair amount of skill. Yeah. So I guess one of the questions that I have for you then is, at what point have researchers been looking at this specifically with girls so far as you can tell?
Very little. Really very little. I mean, there aren't that many serious psychological studies of humor in general. You can find a few, and there was one interesting one where a neurologist actually went to like food courts and college campuses and just sat and watched people interacting and took notes on who was making who laugh and things like that. So he had sort of really good data, but there's very little research done on humor in general and almost none done on humor and gender. So it's something I'd love to see more of.
We're talking to Ellen McCarthy right now. She is a staff writer for The Washington Post, and we're talking about how if you want your girls, your daughters, your female students to be empowered, that looking to humor and cultivating humor might be a good way to achieve that. And so you were just talking a second ago about studies done to look at, even though they aren't necessarily extensive, studies to look at, you know, who is cracking jokes. How does gender play a role between, you know, young men and young women in adolescence when they are, you know, still trying to figure out the world around them?
Right. Yeah. And this is where psychology kind of leaves off and some evolutionary biologists step in with their theories of what happens. And what they would say is humor telegraphs intelligence, right? It takes a certain level of intelligence to be able to come up with a joke, come up with a crack right on the spot and respond. You know, nobody walks around with their SAT scores in their back pocket. You don't necessarily, go on a first date and say, you know, my IQ score is blah, blah, blah. But you can be funny, and that's a way of showing intelligence. And what these evolutionary biologists would say is that women are inherently looking for providers, and it's no longer big, beefy, brawny hunters who will provide best for a family. It is people, men of intelligence that would have the biggest earning capacity. And so it becomes this very sort of basic biological explanation for why men are more likely to crack jokes in crowded bars and in the context of women, and why women might laugh more. There's a, you know, this old saying that, you know, when a guy says that he's looking for a woman with a sense of humor, what he really means is that he wants somebody to laugh at his jokes. And
sure.
It's sort of horrifying, but I think, you know, a lot of us see that in practice, you know, that there's not, when they looked, there was one study that looked at online dating profiles, and it was really important to women to find a guy with a sense of humor. It was really not that important to most guys to find a woman with a sense of humor. And what, the evolutionary biologists would say is that it's not necessarily the sense of humor that people are interested in. It's that next level intelligence that can honestly bring a higher income.
Sure. And so looking back at girls, I mean, I want to use that word sort of generally, but, you know, kids that are female or, you know, identify as female who are trying to still figure out the world. And you spoke with some young girls about trying to be funny, wanting to be funny. You know, what did they tell you?
They told me that they were funny, first of all, right? They see themselves as funny, but they were cognizant of the fact that their humor gets shut down more, both from adults and from boys. Now, I'm talking specifically with girls who've sort of entered middle school, junior high age, and high school. They can really recount times where, you know, a boy would have said to them, "That's not funny, leave it to us." And, you know, another girl remembered a time when she made a joke and everybody kind of sniggered, but then, you know, the boy next to her made a very similar joke and everybody laughed and laughed. You know, and so the girls I talked to were conscious of this and were conscious of the fact that it didn't seem to be winning them a lot of points, either with their teachers or with their male peers. Now, I think that once you get into older high school and into college, all of that sort of shifts and confidence level shifts. But, you know, you got to think about, gosh, you know, in my day it was 17 magazine, but today I know it's all on YouTube. And what's the focus for girls? You know, what does society tell girls they need to focus on? Well, you know, the contours of their makeup, right? Their perfect homecoming outfits, how they look. You know, there's not a lot of Teen Beat magazine saying, here's why it's important to be funny, or here's why you should use your voice and speak up. Even when you're saying something that isn't necessarily popular, it's important to claim your voice. It just isn't the focus, unfortunately, for teenage girls, and I think that they can lose their voice a little bit because of it.
Girls who want to cultivate this have the desire to be funny, want to be funny. We would imagine that their parents would also want them to feel confident. So how can parents help girls find their senses of humor?
Yeah, I think it starts really young, and it starts with modeling, right? If you're funny with your children, boys and girls, of course we want boys to be funny too. I mean, my feeling is, gosh, don't we all just want, especially today, as many people to be funny as possible, just so that we have this great, you know, light, wonderful way of being in the world through humor. So modeling it, being funny with your kids, cracking jokes, telling jokes to each other, being silly, not being afraid to, you know, dance around and be a goofball so that they then feel comfortable doing that. But I think the other thing is encouraging their attempts at humor, even failed attempts, right? Because like we were saying, this is a skill that's practiced. And so when you are out there shooting basketballs, you don't hit every one. But the more you shoot, the better you get. And so praising even attempts at humor that maybe you don't find funny as a parent, but that kid is asking you, "Is that funny, Mom? Is that funny, Dad?" Yeah, just going along with it and laughing. I think those are really important ones. But then also, you know, sharing humor with them, you know, seeking out, if your kids are on YouTube, let's watch some videos Ellen DeGeneres or whoever you, and there are tons of YouTube comedians now, and, you know, steering towards those rather than the, you know, Kim Kardashian style makeup tutorials.
Well, Ellen, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ellen McCarthy is a staff writer for the Washington Post. She joined us today to talk about why cultivating humor in girls can help them be more confident.
Coming up next, Halloween is nearly here, and it's time for you to share what you're going to go as this year. You can call in right now at 800-642-1234. What is your costume, or are you looking for costume suggestions? We can try to help you out. I don't know. I'm not very good at it. Maybe you are.
No, but we can certainly try.
Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. Halloween is a week away, meaning it's crunch time for finishing up our costumes, if any. We want to hear about your costume plans at 800-642-1234. What are you dressing up as this Halloween? Are you going to make your own costume? Are you still trying to come up with that idea? And you can tell us about your best all-time costume or the one that just didn't pan out.
You know, you could be part of a different school of thought. Maybe you want a frightening costume, or maybe you can take a humorous approach. We want to know what those costumes are, or maybe you've been part of a group costume theme. And if you're a procrastinator, what's your last-minute backup plan for this Halloween? Again, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And of course, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll go right to your calls. Tom is with us in Columbus. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Howdy. Happy Halloween.
To you too. What's your costume, Tom?
I'm going to go as a tornado.
Okay. How are you going to do that?
Started with a hula hoop suspended from the ceiling and then chicken wired the funnel and landscape fabric. My wife is Dorothy. And got a Wicked Witch, a Flying Monkey, a Tin Man. So we're doing an ensemble. It should be really good. And we're going for the money. We're going to only the places that pay the highest because we tend to win. So you're
going to contests with this.
Yeah.
Best one ever. The one that I won the most cash for was quite some time ago, but I did Sinead O'Connor and did the bald wig and the combat boots and the whole nine yards. And I was lucky.
Clearly, Tom, when it comes to Halloween costumes, nothing compares to you.
I do like the just got that. I also like that there's like the kind of financial aspect
of
they're
playing to win here,
yeah,
people.
They're not messing around, guys. Next, we're going to go to Tommy in Brookfield. Tommy, what are you going as for Halloween this year?
My wife and I have a party every 2 years. We invite like about 200 people
and a lot of theater
people, and it's a lot of fun. And we're going this year as ventriloquist dolls.
Oh, that's interesting. How are you going to do that?
Well, we're kind of going after the Charlie McCarthy and his sidekick puppet also, the Edgar Bergen dolls.
Uh-huh.
And so they're going to be kind of spooky, but still friendly.
Hmm.
And we're putting big rings on our back, and we're both wearing like tuxedos and top hat and monocle, things like that.
What was the movie with is Anthony Perkins, right, and the killer... ventriloquist dummy. That might be what people think of. I'll warn you now. Magic?
Right.
Magic was
Magic.
The movie. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay. Well, maybe, try to have a more happy, innocent time on this one. And Tommy, enjoy that party. It sounds like a blast.
Thank you.
We are taking your calls. We want to hear your Halloween costume plans this year or your best or worst Halloween costume of all time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We asked around at work here. Nigel, one of our engineers, said the first time I convinced my mom to get me a store-bought costume, it was a mismatched Darth Vader suit with a stormtrooper mask. You know, Darth Vader's doing some quality control work on the Death Star. He's posing.
Oh, yeah. It's one of those undercover boss sort of situations. Or maybe it's like a higher level stormtrooper. You never know. I think one of my favorites that we got from the WPR team was from our very own Chris Molina, who dressed up as the Menards guy in high school.
Right, from the commercials
if you know
the
Save Big Money at Menards, who used to walk around. Mm. And I have fond memories of those commercials. I'm really glad that someone took the time to say, that's what I want to go as for Halloween.
Chris has a good costume game. We'll go back to your calls now. Devin is with us in Milwaukee. Devin, hi.
Hi, I'm going to be Miss Frizzle.
Yay.
And the dog Artemis is going to be my magic school bus.
Oh, okay. That sounds great. And are you going to be the original Miss Frizzle, or there's like a new one coming out now, right?
Yeah, I think it's the...
You know, I was going to go with the original from my childhood, but I teach now, and I'm a redhead, and it just works.
Perfect. That sounds like a lot. And is the dog okay with the magic school bus costume?
We'll see. She'll try it on for a little bit.
All right, long enough for a picture. Good luck. That sounds like a lot of fun.
And another suggestion, or not suggestion, that we got was from Brandy Funk, who tells us about the costume that her 12-year-old wore. So I guess her daughter and her friends are going as food this year. Mm-hmm. So one is going as a taco or a donut, a burger or a Chinese takeout box, which reminded me that just as an adult recently, I went as one part of a s'more to a Halloween party when I was still in Detroit. And obviously no one understood what we went as, because we were all just wearing sweatsuits in various colors saying that we were s'mores.
Were you actually standing next to each other to convey the concept?
Every once in a while, and then sometimes we would just say, I'm a marshmallow or a graham cracker. Didn't quite work.
Back to your Halloween costume calls. We've got Sean on the line in Spooner. Sean, hi.
Hey, so I'm a huge Walking Dead fan, and I'm actually going to be setting up a scene from that on my porch and everything, and kind of portray that as the kids walk by and hand them candy and everything.
Okay, that could be mighty creepifying. Are you worried about scaring away the littler ones, Sean?
Well, it's going to be instead of...
Oh, we're losing the line, Sean, but good luck with the Walking Dead display, it sounds like,
sure,
plus costume.
Yeah.
He's going all in on that.
I mean, some people really do go all out on Halloween, and more power to the people who are like, you know what, this is what I'm doing this year. I'm going to have that 200-person party.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I'm not a big Halloween dress-up guy, I'll admit. I won't. I usually do something sort of poorly thought out right in the last minute. Hey, look, a funny hat. We'll go next to Peter on the line in Wausau. Peter, hi.
Hi.
What are you going to dress as this year, Peter?
A referee.
For what sport?
Football.
Okay. I don't know. Are you worried that people are going to be mad at you for a call that they didn't like over the weekend?
Maybe.
Okay. And how old are you, Peter, if I may ask? Nine. Okay. And what's your favorite candy, Peter?
I'd have to say Snickers.
Snickers. And are you going to throw the flag if people try to give you a toothbrush?
Maybe.
Peter, thank you so much. Good luck refereeing out there. That's a fun one.
Yeah, I like that.
Pretty
one.
Pretty easy to pull off, too.
And I think that people would listen. You have the arm motions to indicate a poor call or something like that.
Yeah, I can think of a Packer playoff game where a referee would be a pretty scary costume.
Oh, that's true.
He did. That was not a catch. Anyway, I won't go back to that 49ers game.
Oh.
All right, back to our calls now. Gina in Milwaukee. Gina, hi.
Hi. Fun topic.
Yeah, what's your costume, Gina?
Well, my husband is turning 40 a few days before we take the kids trick-or-treating, and the movie Saturday Night Fever came out in 1977, so we're going to embarrass them and go as disco people if they even remember or know what that is.
And so how are you going to pull that off? What are the key elements of the costume?
Sure, we're going to do the guy and girl thing, and he has been dying his whole life to find a leisure suit, so now is the perfect opportunity for that. And I am actually a collector of clothes, so I have original dresses that my mom wore when she was doing it, so I'm just going to wear an old mom dress.
And there will be dancing involved, I hope?
I'm sure. We do it all the time, so I'm sure while we're outside, absolutely.
Gina, thanks a lot for that call. That's probably all the time we have for callers. You can keep sharing your Halloween costume plans over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brianne Chasso on the other side of the glass, her best costumes. Poison Ivy. I had to ask the DC comic character or the plant or the skin condition. It was the comic book one.
Oh, well, good.
What, do you have a favorite? Like s'mores?
Oh, I love the s'mores. I've got to give myself credit for that.
You can, again, share your costumes on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
So we have some breaking news for you. Wisconsin is going to be the guinea pig for a new fast food product. It's from Taco Bell, and spoiler alert, it's a dessert, and it's called the Kit Kat Chocadilla.
So it's a quesadilla, right? But instead of the usual stuff inside the tortilla, You know, there's not the cheese and all that. It's filled with Kit Kat candy bars.
And so when Rob and I were talking about this earlier today, I obviously got confused and thought that it was a quesadilla, just standard quesadilla with cheese and all the other stuff he just mentioned, and Kit Kats, which maybe would work for some people.
Yeah, I don't know. And salsa, I don't think so. So it's just the sweet stuff inside a tortilla, which if you think of it, speaking of s'mores, like a s'more, I guess it makes
sense.
Yeah,
I think it could pass. But I think throughout the day, I think I convinced myself that I would probably try a Kit Kat quesadilla if it was actually cheese and Kit Kats, which feels
okay.
Kind of gross.
That's weird, yeah. So this is going to be a selected Taco Bells. We don't know where, but it occurs to me, quesadillas, I learned a long time ago, are like the easiest food to make. It would not be hard to take a pan, heat it up, put down a tortilla, put on some Kit Kats, put on another tortilla. Boom, you've made your own Kit Kat quesadilla. Don't sell it. Taco Bell will probably sue you, I imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, if you want the experience, you can still try.
Do it at home. Make your own. DIY. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.